8 o'clock. 8:01. Good morning, everyone. And with that gavel, I will convene the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. Today is Monday, February 12th. Welcome, everyone, to week two.
Week two
of the short session. And colleagues, just to give you a quick overview of where we are heading, today I am going to conduct a hearing and work session on 4052, the Small Business Rules Advisory Committee. We're then going to continue open hearings on 4023, the broadband bill. We are going to be looking at the Dash 2 and Dash 6 amendments today, but we are working on some additional amendments and are planning to take final action on this bill on Wednesday. I just didn't want to make it so easy that people came in, testified, we took a work session, went home. I'm trying to encourage people to stick around and stay interested. So again, we'll look at the Dash 2s and Dash 6s in particular today. Probably I expect to move to adopt those, but not to take final action on the bill until Wednesday. We had also scheduled activity on 4121, the House Wrap bill today, but that one is also a work in progress, and so we are holding that over until Wednesday. Did I miss anything, Ms. Leone?
You did not.
All right, we are good. So I'm going to start by opening a public hearing. Let me make sure I call the right one, on 4052. And I'm going to ask Ms. Leone to give us an introduction to that, and I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Brock Smith, because I'll be testifying on this one.
You are a brave man, sir.
Well, I get it back when I'm done.
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 4052 establishes the Small Business Rules Advisory Committee to serve as an advisory committee for agencies adopting new administrative rules and to review the effectiveness of existing administrative rules. It requires the State Archives to provide administrative support to the committee. It also requires the Secretary of State to compile rule review reports and submit annually to the Legislative Assembly. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact. We have Dash 2s posted on OLIS.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am still David Gomberg, State Representative from House District 10, and I'm very pleased to be with you today to discuss House Bill 4052, dealing with rules and small businesses. And colleagues, I'm sure I don't need to explain to you that businesses struggle with rules as they are adopted, but particularly small businesses struggle with rules because, for the most part, they don't have in-house HR departments, accountants, or attorneys. In most cases, the HR department may be the mom-and-pop spouse as they work their way through the process. So as we go through the rulemaking process after we adopt legislation, we want to be cognizant and considerate of the impact that these changes will have, particularly on our smallest businesses. And to provide that attention, the legislature, in their wisdom, has made changes to ORS 183 that require a small business impact statement whenever rules are adopted. A good thing, I believe, but being implemented, I must say, on a spotty basis. Some agencies, some departments, some branches of government doing a very good job in developing a small business impact statement when they develop rules. Others not adopting any kind of impact statement at all. And when questioned, at least one agency said to me, it's not the rules that affect small business, it's only the legislation that affects small business, so we don't need to follow through with adopting one of these impact statements. So taking a look at 183 and trying to figure out how we can do a better job, one of the things that we encountered is that the statute requires every time an impact statement is developed that the agency create a small business advisory committee to assist them in reviewing the rule. Each time they develop a rule, they must also create a small business advisory committee. And some of them have been doing a good job on that, but sometimes they are challenged, particularly very small agencies, in pulling together a group that can provide them with some feedback. So in looking at 183 and talking in particular with the Small Business Assistance Center and the Secretary of State's office, we developed the concept that we would create a standing committee that could assist any agency in the rulemaking process. Now, I need to make it very, very clear that My proposal in 4052 does not prevent an agency from creating their own panel of experts who have some special expertise in their subject area or their agency. It simply creates a standing committee that can be called on in general anytime an agency doesn't want to create their own committee. So that is the essence of 4052. In developing it for presentation in the short session, there were some other concepts that were attached to the bill, but on further consideration, I thought, and people I was working with thought, that they were probably not good subjects for the short session. Provocative subjects, subjects worth pursuing, but not good subjects for the short session, which is why we developed the -2 amendments to pull those other concepts out and simply focus on the issue of creating a standing committee that could be available to help agencies when they review small business impact of rules that are underway. That's the essence of the bill, colleagues. I would be happy to answer any questions for you.
Are there any questions of the representative?
Thank you.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gomberg, I appreciate this bill. And one, as you and I know, I just want to point out that I'm glad that you did the 91 days. Thank you for doing that. The whole idea behind this is great. I think it's a great idea. I've pointed out in this committee before, I think before when there was a previous chair here, the same thing came up. Whenever we have a committee that's appointed by, in essence, one side, I just wonder if there's a way we could put something in there that allows input from the minority leaders of the two chambers in some sort of way, so that there's some input and perhaps some input from an outside business organization, if that makes sense.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Post, I understand your point. In crafting this measure, we followed the standard process that's in place for appointing similar committees and task forces.
Right.
However, I would point out that that when you say one side, we have multiple parties that are appointing members of the standing committee, which include the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, but also the Governor, and also one member appointed by the Office of Small Business Assistance and another by the State Archivist, both of which are subunits of the Secretary of State. So we have the Governor, the Secretary of State, the President of the House, the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate all involved. I understand your point about minority leaders in those two houses making appointments. Again, I just followed the standard process that we've had for similar task forces and committees in the past.
I kind of assume that, so thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions for the representative?
Thank you all.
Thank you, Representative.
And we don't have anyone else signed up.
All right. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 4052, and we will
open a work session on 4052. Thank you for striking the base here and not my cell phone. They're sitting side by side, and I always worry that I'm going to hit the wrong object here on the desk. So we've opened a work session on 4052. Vice Chair Brock Smith, might you have a motion regarding the amendments?
I do, Mr. Chair. Chair Gomberg, I move to adopt the -2 amendments for House Bill 4052.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The amendments are adopted. Again, Vice Chair Brock Smith, anything further on 4052?
I believe we do have some more work on 4052, Mr. Chair. And with that, Chair Gomberg, I move 4052 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and then a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you very much. Ms. Leone, we do have a letter from the Speaker's office indicating that with the amendments there is no fiscal impact with this measure and that the referral to Ways and Means therefore would be rescinded.
Correct.
All right. Colleagues, any discussion on the main motion to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. I will be happy to carry that bill to the floor, and I will close the work session on 4052. Thank you all.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I am now going to move to reopening the public hearing excuse me, on 4023. And I think we have a sign-up sheet. Again, just wanted to make sure everybody's aware. Today we are looking in particular at the Dash 2 and Dash 6 amendments. There are other amendments underway. And colleagues, I have six people who are signed up to testify. I'm going to call Mr. Weidman. Travis Miller and Alex Pettit to come forward.
We'll actually hold our public testimony until we get to the other amendments.
That's very good. All right, thank you so much. Then, so I'll invite Mr. Wolf and Mr. Pastrick if they'd like to come up. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Do I need to move?
I hope not.
It's again. I've already had
it. Welcome.
Chair Bromberg, Vice Chairs Marsh and Rocksmith and committee members, thank you very much for your time this morning. I'm Michael Weidman, the president and CEO of Lightspeed Networks. LS Networks is an Oregon corporation owned by five rural power electric cooperatives and one tribal nation, the Kirkwells. We represent the financial interest of about 70,000 Oregonians, you know, perhaps your constituents or at least their friends and neighbors. So I do appreciate your time this morning. We operate a region-wide high-speed broadband network. High-speed, I'm talking about like 4 terabits, which is 4,000 times gigabits, or 4,000 times 1,000 times megabits. So it is a high-capacity network. The preponderance of my comments were actually on things that you don't want to talk about today. So unfortunately, you know, we'll set those away, and I'm going to be on a plane, so I'm going to probably ask those messages to be communicated on my behalf on Wednesday. So as it relates to the Dash 2 and the Dash 6 amendments that the committee is considering today, we have no opposition on those. You know, creating a local broadband champion is a great thing, and we are clearly an advocate of the E-rate funding program that creates a lot of opportunity for the federal matching funds, so we also support that. So, Mr. Chair, you know, given the limited agenda today, that would generally conclude my comments, but I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee that may present.
I know that you haven't seen any of the additional amendments that are pending, but I certainly don't want to cut you off if you had anything in general you wanted to share with us on the measure.
Generally speaking, we've seen this bill grow arms and legs, and if this is what the committee does on a regular basis, thank you all very much for your service, because this has been a trial by, you know, fire for me. We generally oppose the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments. It seems like it facilitates the overbuild of the private investments that my shareholders have created. It was our intent to create, it might have been at Dash 7, but it hasn't hit the streets, which tried to mitigate the risk of those Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments by trying to create some boundaries. In the bigger picture of things, it would be our thought that perhaps we could update a needs assessment. Recently, you know, the South Owasco School District was highlighted as having only a couple hundred kilobits of information. Over the last 6 months, you know, we invested significant money into MOPN. And that school actually has gigabit, you know, 1,000 megabits per second line rate symmetric both ways, as I testify this morning. I think it would be useful to be able to take that, you know, updated needs assessment and for the Office of the CIO and industry to work together and collaborate and create solutions in harmony rather than competition.
All right, thank you very much. Any questions,
Chair.
Colleagues? Appreciate you being with us very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Wolf, welcome.
Good morning. Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, Brant Wolf with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. We represent telecommunications carriers that provide high-speed internet access throughout Oregon and in particular in rural parts of the state. My comments are in relation to the Dash 6s. As you heard me last week, our members take advantage of the E-rate program along with schools in some of the places where they serve to provide broadband to these schools and libraries. We supported this notion last week. We didn't have any language to look at, now we do. I'm just here to reiterate our support of the Dash Sixes, and at the appropriate time, ask the committee to adopt them and move them out with a favorable recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Mr. Pastrick, welcome back.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. So, Sam Pastrick, for the record, Oregon Citizens Utility Board. I was here last week. So, I do want to ask, and I know we're focusing on the Dash 2 and the Dash 6. CUB is in full support of both. If you'll allow me, though, I would, however, like to comment on the Dash 3 and Dash 4 really briefly, if that's okay with you all.
Please.
Thank you. So again, Oregon CUB is Oregon's residential utility ratepayer advocate, and we do focus on internet issues now as we do consider the internet to be an essential utility service in the same vein, more or less, as water or electricity, although to be clear, it is not regulated as such. CUB supports 4023 with amendments because we believe the bill would strategically embolden the state CIO office with really the appropriate provisions to facilitate more competitive, effective, and efficient partnership opportunities, not just with the private sector, I want to point out. And this would include cable companies, incumbent phone companies, as well as non-telecom providers, but also existing or newly formed municipal broadband or more local jurisdictional providers. So it's worth noting that we are keenly aware of the concerns highlighted around the Dash 3 and the Dash 4. However, our belief is that with this greater statutory flexibility outlined in those amendments, the Chief Information Office has every ability and every intention to leverage those state assets wisely and for really the benefit of Oregon internet customers, not, as some would argue, duplicate those efforts or disadvantage perhaps the private sector in some way. So I do want to close just by saying that really, the reality in Oregon, and to be clear, Oregon is not alone. This is an issue across the country, is that there are still way too many areas across the state lacking adequate broadband connectivity. And the larger problem in these areas is often already that there's an economic disadvantage. And really, without this 21st century infrastructure, as well as quality access to that infrastructure, and again, we're talking about broadband here, these Oregonians, I would argue, CUB would argue, are at an even further disadvantage. So again, 4023 would strategically seek to remedy this compounding issue. So again, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs Marsh and Brock Smith, committee members, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Pastrick? Vice Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Pastrick, thanks for your testimony.
And, yeah.
I think that I'm glad that we all know that there are some concerns over the Dash 3s and Dash 4s. Mm-hmm. You know, in my district, not to pick one company over another, but Charter Communications, Charter Spectrum, of course, supplies the broadband and high-speed internet. Mm-hmm. Service for many of my constituents, and in doing so, they've rolled out a lower income package for a lot of our low income families throughout the district that is very cost effective. Mm. And so I believe that, you know, again, market driven, they're offering these things. Would you agree that are you familiar with this type of a package that we have for our lower income families? And B, would you agree that that there are companies out there that are offering this niche, if you will, for service for broadband mm-hmm. to citizens? Because I'll add that the market drove Charter to supply a route redundancy line from Grants Pass over to Northern California and Brookings at a tremendous cost, but it has been highly successful because if somebody's digging on Highway 42 suddenly and hit a line, suddenly Fred Meyer in Brookings, Oregon is without the ability to process credit cards and debit cards.
Sure. Vice Chair Brocksmith, so to be clear, I'm not intimately familiar with the particulars of Charter's low-income package, although I do know that it exists. There are two others of which I'm aware, although somewhat recently, One of them is no longer available, and that was through CenturyLink, and then also Comcast has a sort of a low-income offering, although that program is specific to families with children, as well as low-income housing, those who occupy low-income housing. So again, I'm not intimately familiar with Charter's package. So I guess what I would say in response is that there certainly have been opportunities where sort of the market has allowed for these low-income packages to take up some share. I guess our belief and what I would argue is that between those three programs, again, one of which no longer exists, that did previously exist through CenturyLink, it's just not covering the need in the way that I think or that Cub thinks is appropriate. And that, you know, frankly, broadband is very, very expensive. It's expensive. I think probably most folks up here would agree that it's far too expensive. Another point that I would probably add is that with a lot of the low-income program offerings, it's very difficult to receive adequate speed. So, you know, the FCC very recently had sort of signaled broadband or high-speed internet as being, 25 megabits up and 3 megabits down. The CenturyLink package, for instance, that had been available to low-income customers was offering speeds well below that. So I think sort of the combination of there just not being enough low-income offerings for folks and that the speeds aren't often adequate to meet their needs, at least needs nowadays, is, I think, really problematic. And again, I don't want to suggest that there is not opportunity in the market for low-income program offerings to sort of crop up. I just don't think the need is met. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Representative Post, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Brant, I got to pick on you just because.
Please.
I know who you are. I talked to the CIO about this a little bit the other day in my office, and with this, the Dash 2, the Dash 6, and the changes that it makes, we've talked before about St. Paul,
yes.
Obviously. I mean, it still amazes me that 23 miles or so up the road that it's like going to the middle of eastern Oregon.
Right.
Is there hope here that we could perhaps do something through the companies with the help of this, if we adopt these amendments? Would there be where are you at on that? What do you think can happen with
St.
Paul specifically? And I know that's specific to, and nobody else in the rest of this state cares, but I care.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Post, as I mentioned earlier, and I haven't spoken in any detail here in my testimony, but just when a local school like St. Paul, for example, if they either don't have the service that they need or they think they need or it's too expensive for them, they can use the E-rate program to alleviate those problems. And they do. A lot of schools take advantage of that program. To the extent the Dash 6 is, and that's what I'm talking about here, would give a school, any local school, the ability to kind of beef that up a little bit or to make it happen at all. We think that is something that would happen and could happen if these DAC systems are adopted and the money's appropriated. I to answer you directly, I think it's a good thing. Selfishly, our members might take advantage of that to help these schools, but we do that now, and I believe fully that it could happen again. Absolutely. I have no reason to think otherwise, I guess would be my answer to you.
Okay. So follow up, please. So, again, this we're talking. See, I heard a little bit of testimony between the vice chair and I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name already.
Patrick.
Thank you, Patrick. It's amazing that I can remember his. you're talking schools, and this is schools, and this is what I think we're all discussing here is schools. I'm trying to think also as well as the folks who live in the town that are locked out of high-speed internet. I don't want government necessarily providing that to the people in St. Paul, but if government's going to lay the, I'm really simplifying this, but laying the, How can this affect the people outside of the school in a place like St. Paul? Maybe that's what I'm trying to ask.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Post. So as I mentioned last week, if it's not the worst thing that can happen to one of our members, it has to be the top two or three, is to be overbuilt by some unit of government, local government or the state, whoever it would be, when there's fiber already existing. That is really our concern with the twos and threes, or I'm sorry, the threes and fours.
Okay.
And that's our concern. It happens. It has happened, and we don't like that. It strands investment that people have made, and it shouldn't happen. To the extent that Dash 6's attempt to address that in Section C or Subsection C, Section 4, we went back and forth on this with a drafter and with other interested parties. It's not quite as strong as we would like it, but we will take that. That's good language in our opinion, and we hope to work in the rulemaking process to maybe beef that up a little bit. Okay. The threes and fours, in my opinion, and I did not intend to testify about these today, but to me, that is a big intrusion in our business. And I don't think proper time has been given to this to consider it fully. I do think, and I'll, on the record, I will say, I think we can get there. I just don't think we can do that in 24 hours. I think more thought needs to be given to that. And that's, I guess, all I can say. Our association historically has been very, very strong in opposition to government built networks. But in our opinion, that day has passed. We have advocated against that for years and years and years. We've introduced legislation to get at that, and those days are gone. Local governments are in this business, and the best thing we can do now is to deal with this situation and try to alleviate any kind of concerns that we have about that. That is our goal, not to kill things like this, but to work with them and to make them work with us as we do our jobs. There's government fiber around that we use occasionally to access long haul, not local retail stuff, but kind of a long haul fiber. So I don't know if that's maybe answers your question a little bit. I don't know.
Thanks. I appreciate it. And I didn't mean to drug you into the three and four, but yeah, I appreciate that you're saying that. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Brant, just some of the mechanics of this that I'm trying to grasp with on top of Representative Post's question. So if you had to run a main line from Kaiser up to St. Paul and the E-rate would pay for 80% to 90% of that. And the other day they said they would pay for the lines basically just going to the school. But if you added on to that businesses, farms, communities, who owns that line that would be put in from, say, Kaiser up to St. Paul? So who owns the line that you can tap into, you know, at a community level, and then who owns those community lines, I guess?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, I will attempt to answer this, but I think Michael might be, I don't want to speak for you, Michael, but I think you guys do a lot of this kind of work. Is that correct? You use E-rate and things like that?
We have.
So my answer to that question is, if it's an ESD or a school or whoever, if it's their project and they get the funding, I believe that they would own it. It would be theirs to own and operate and maintain. And as far as getting an off ramp of that long haul so somebody else could use it, I don't know that there is a way to do that. But I that's an answerable question, and I could certainly provide that answer to you.
Follow up?
Yeah. Well, what they were talking about the other day was the E-rate would only be responsible for building a big enough line just to handle that.
Right.
So it
right.
would have to be beefed up or a larger, more fiber going up there. So that's kind of my question is then who owns that extra amount of fiber that goes up to service the other potential customer?
Right. Sir, I think so. The question you ask, I don't think is – it's not easily answered exactly. I think if it's an E-rate project specifically, I think the project and the program will only fund the school or the library. I don't think you can, I could be wrong about this, but I don't think you can add extra capacity and then use that for businesses or residents along the way. I don't think that's part of the process. But I will double check that and make sure. But I think an E-rate program an E-rate school or library earn project is specifically for that particular thing and nothing else.
Another follow-up?
To belabor this.
No.
But the other day they said, look, if we're going to be plowing a cable up there, the cost of plowing that cable is already done. I mean, that's part of the E-rate cost that they will provide. To not put in a larger capacity cable at that time would be foolish. And so that's what I'm saying is, basically, if you're doing this, that putting in the hardware is going to cost a little more, but who owns that hardware? And then if you're talking about the private sector companies, you know, feeding off of that, and there are several private companies that do this, you know, then do they bid on that? That's kind of my question.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Braille, let me say this. The cost of the projects is involved in the construction. That's the big expense. So to the extent a private provider could put fiber into a conduit, I think that could certainly happen.
Okay.
And that would satisfy whatever other local need might be met. But I think that can happen, actually. In fact, there are efforts underway to make sure that when a ditch is open and there's a conduit there, that private providers have the ability to access that and put fiber into that conduit. That still is separate, and I know this is kind of splitting hairs, but that's still separate from the E-rate project and program, but a private provider could access that conduit and put their own fiber in there, which is far, far less expensive than actually having to go in and plow in and get all the permits and all that kind of stuff and engineer the project. I mean, I think that's a fair answer to that. And
thank
I don't
you.
Know if you want to add anything to that or not, but.
Am I allowed to just jump right in? Chair Gomberg, if it would please the committee, I'd be happy to add a few more words to that.
Okay. Not a lot more words.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Moretto, so technically E-rate funds can only be used for that school. It is prudent, as you indicate, sir, you know, to build in additional fiber. Okay, that's called excess capacity for the FCC and USEC funds. Okay, they haven't defined how excess capacity is to be treated, so it often results in audits, which are very time-consuming, and there's still not a clear definition at the federal level on that. But the underlying facility is still owned by the carrier that is contracted to put it in. But the challenge really lies into then the last mile distribution. So, you know, in order to get to that school, you might pass through a community, and you might even create a point of presence. But then getting it out to the residents is still very high cost, anywhere from, you know, $15,000 a mile for clear poles. Well, Portland's $200 a foot. You know, so construction is still going to cost you, you know, tens of thousands or even in the six-figure or higher amounts. And if you're looking at low-cost solutions, you know, even $100 per customer, it's going to take 10 to 15 years, assuming you can collect the revenue, in order to pay for that access facility. So the access becomes a bigger challenge even beyond just the anchor tenant.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the
thank you very much.
You.
Any other questions from Representative Barreto, Representative Brock Smith?
Well, I appreciate this dialogue and conversation, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the questions, Representative Barreto. I think to summarize, so it's clear in my mind that the Dash 6 amendment we're all in support of.
Yes.
And it will help leverage federal dollars to get these you get the broadband connections that are necessary to our school systems throughout the state. One of the benefits of that is the heavy cost, of course, is, you know, getting the permits and the necessary construction, if you will, and digging the hole and for as long as it takes to get from point A to point B. While that hole is open, there's opportunities for various telecom companies to put some fiber in a pipe and drop it in the hole at much less cost, because the associated heavy costs are being carried by the E-rate, if you will, and the federal dollars that are leveraged out of this. Correct?
I believe that's an accurate thing to
say. And then, as you just summarized, then it's up to the telecom companies to decide whether or not that fiber is cost effective to invest in moving it out from those areas, which I think, Mr. Patrick, this could actually assist in making sure that we can have more affordable fiber through to our companies through our companies to our individuals in low-income communities. So
certainly, Representative Smith. Brock Smith, I wouldn't disagree with that.
Further questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anybody else that would like to testify to us today on 4023? We're up to consideration of the dash nines. This is your last opportunity to get us into double digits. I'm not hearing anybody else come forward, so I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on 4023, and I will open a work session on 4023. Colleagues, we have a couple of amendments before us, and for anybody following this measure, whether you're in the room or listening to the recordings, let me apologize for the process that we're going through, working our way through so many amendments so quickly. They get posted. There's a little time to respond to them. I think this is illustrative of the challenges we face with deadlines and procedures in the short session. If you have any further questions about that, I can arrange a committee tour of a local sausage-making plant, and we can compare the two. But Representative Brock Smith, we're in work session. Might you have any motions regarding amendments on? I'm sorry, was Representative Marsh going to handle this one?
I got it.
All right. If we could defer, Representative Marsh, might you have any amendments on 4023?
Chair Gomberg, I move to adopt the dash two amendment.
All right, there's been a motion to adopt the dash twos. Is there discussion?
Yeah, just a quick question.
Please, Representative Post.
Mr. Chair, just as you know so well, so both these amendments have the dreaded E clause. Is there a reason why, don't they?
Oh, E,
I think they
dash six does, for sure.
Could we, I know it's late, I don't want to clog up the system, but why not the 91 days of which your bill just did a short while ago? 91 days is not a lot of time.
Well, I think the reason for the E, the emergency clause on the dash two is that the Broadband Council is in the midst of putting together its biennial report, and the dash two suggests that this discussion be included in that report, which is due out in November. So it expedites their ability to look at the material.
Further discussion on that, Representative Post?
No, I was just doing math in my head. So. Okay.
Further discussion on the dash twos? If anybody is interested in taking a second look at the issue of emergency clauses, and Representative Post, my record, like yours, is pretty clear on e-clauses. We do have dash nines that are in the works, and if we think there's an opportunity or a need to remove emergency clauses from either of these two amendments, there's an opportunity to do it there. Okay. Am I correct in that, Ms. Leone?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. The problem on the dash twos and the dash sixes is the dash sixes has the allocation of funding, and so you need the fund to put the allocation into in the short term as opposed to 91 days. Correct, there is 3 months versus 6 months on the dash twos there.
Okay. Representative McEwen.
Chair Gomberg, thank you so much. I think I have a process question this morning. So we have dash nines that we haven't seen yet, is that correct?
Yes, and so we'll be hearing those on Wednesday.
So the intent this morning is to adopt current amendments, but then on Wednesday revisit this issue with new amendments.
That's correct.
I guess my question is, do we need to adopt these amendments this morning if there are other things coming on Wednesday that we aren't quite sure of what they are yet?
I was just conferring with staff on that. I think that the dash nines are going to be a distinct issue, that these are separate questions, and just as a matter of saving time, since we have it today, I was going to go ahead and move those today. There's no reason we couldn't hold over until Wednesday, although the Wednesday calendar is getting a little crowded.
Can we take a little break?
Sure, let's stand at ease.
Thank you.
time, ever.
All right, we are back on the record, and when we recessed, we were discussing a motion to adopt the Dash 2 amendments of House Bill 2023, and on reflection, I think that we have got some time if we'd like to consider all of these amendments at the same time and look at the big picture rather than individual pieces of it, and I'm certainly comfortable holding over the discussion of the Dash 2s and the Dash 6s until Wednesday. Procedurally, we have a motion before us, and I believe the most efficient way of dealing with that is just simply tabling the motion until we can either withdraw the motion or table it until Wednesday. Ms. Leone, you're my process expert. Either of those seem like a better way to proceed?
Mr. Chair, I am probably not the best answer to that question. So if you want to know which is the best course of action, I need to check with I'm sorry, my apologies, but I do need to check. But I believe they are both options.
So there, we would not be getting into procedural problem if Representative Marsh simply withdrew her motion.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, I would withdraw the motion on the floor.
Very good. All right, we are back to the work session on the full bill. Colleagues, again, this is not a reflection that people either oppose or support the amendments, but rather that that there is a preference that we deal with all of them at once. So we're going to go ahead and hold over 4023 and the amendments until Wednesday, and I'm going to go ahead and close the work session. Representative Clem, I noticed that you were not yet with us when we took a final vote on 4052. I would be happy to request that the rules be suspended so you can vote on that one.
Okay.
Okay.
If you don't, I mean, if you're happy to.
I'm very happy to. Would anybody? Representative Marsh.
Chair Gomberg, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow a Representative Clinton to be recorded as voting on the motion.
All right.
It will not change the outcome of the vote taken.
Right. Colleagues, you've heard the motion to suspend the rules so that Representative Clem can cast a vote on 4023. It will not change the outcome. That's a non-debatable motion. Is there objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Representative Clem, how do you feel about 4052?
Aye.
All right. Thank you. We'll have that recorded. Colleagues, we had scheduled some time today to consider the broadband in total. As you've obviously seen, it is a work in progress, and we're moving toward Wednesday. Because we expected to get most of the work done today, we had scheduled a start time on Wednesday at 9 o'clock. I'm going to try and stay with that time. If there are any changes to the agenda, we will not only post them, but I'll ask staff to call everyone's office if there's any change. But at this point, we're scheduled to come in at 9 and to address the broadband bill and also the House wrap bill. Any questions on that? And if there's no questions, I'm going to do something unusual, and that is give you an hour of your time back during the short session. And I am going to adjourn the meeting.
Thank you.